step up on the balcony. At the senior manager level, I find that people are just learning more and more to be strategic, right? And you're not just leading a team. You might be leading a couple of teams or teams of teams, and you've got to be able to get up on the balcony and see the bigger picture and see how your strategy connects to the bigger company strategies.
Welcome to the Super Managers Podcast, where we interview leaders from all walks of life to tease out the habits, thought patterns, learnings, and experiences that help them be extraordinary at the fine craft of management. Our goal is to bring you the lessons and the insights so that you don't have to learn through your own mistakes, but so that you can shortcut your way to being a great leader. This podcast is brought to you by Fellow, a software platform that helps managers and their teams collaborate on meeting agendas, track action items, and turn chaotic meetings into productive work sessions. Check it out at www.fellow.app. Hey, fellow managers and leaders, I'm Aiden, and I'm the CEO of Fellow.app. Today, I'm very excited to introduce you to Justin McSherry. He's had an extensive leadership career, including at companies like Paragon Technical, Skyline Group, Quantcast. Today, he's a senior director of learning and development at Dropbox. Today, we dive into a number of different topics. Justin's background is really about learning and development, but also people development. So really diving into how to develop people, how to develop leaders. And he's built a lot of different programs across a variety of different companies, including management training, leadership development, executive development. And we dive into a lot of the learnings that he's had throughout his career. Amongst the things that we talk about today are the elements of building a management training practice, how it works, lessons he's learned, also talking about how companies that are even smaller can do some basic things to get managers in their company working together, the idea of peer groups for managers, and using that as a training ground to uplevel everybody at the craft, the idea of building accelerator programs, what some people call high potential programs within companies, and also how to change and get an entire company to think differently about a new area. In this particular case, I think these days a lot of companies are trying to focus and shift their staff to think about AI and really become AI first companies in the way that they think, in the way they develop products, in the way they develop teams. And Dropbox recently went through such a transformation. And so we talk about some of the practical things that Justin and team were able to do to really help with this new mindset of being AI first and getting the entire company to start to think in this way. So before we dive in, just a quick note that if you haven't given us a review on this podcast yet, it takes 2 seconds. We really appreciate it. If you could give us a 5-star review, it's your reviews that really help this podcast stand out, help us get the guests that we do and build the audience that also then joins the Super Managers Workspace. So if you want to join our community, you can do that. Send us an email to supermanagers@fellow.app and we will let you in. And with that said, and without further ado, here's Justin McSherry on this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. Justin, welcome to the show.
All right. Thanks, Aiden.
Super excited to do this. So I know you've worked at a number of different companies. You've been at companies like Paragon, Skyline, Quantcast. Today, you're senior director of L&D, learning and development at Dropbox. But before we get into a lot of the learnings around leadership and the work that you've done across these companies, I just wanted to start from the very beginning and see if you remember when you first started to manage or lead a team. What were some of those early mistakes that you used to make?
I definitely remember leading my first team. One mistake I made was I needed to have all the answers. I mean, I was leading the sales enablement team at Quantcast. And I felt that moving from an IC to manager, you're doing all this IC work, you're sort of the expert and subject matter expert in certain topics, and that I had to really know everything as a manager. What I found is that it was really all about driving outcomes through the team. And so therefore, it required delegation, empowerment of team members. It required a lot of really good listening and empathy. Sometimes I start a one-on-one super tactically, and I realize, you know, this person doesn't need a lot of tactics right now. This person just needs to be listened to. They're venting, they're struggling, or they're upset with something. So there'd be a lot of context switching into just different modes, I found. Situational leadership came in handy, which is around how you work with each and meet with each person where they are in terms of their level of ability. And so I had you just constantly reading and sort of assessing. And a lot of that I had to learn by trial and error. Some of it came naturally. I would find the coaching came naturally, but a lot of it was through trial and error. But coaching questions, a lot of question asking. And another thing that I've learned a lot about myself was I had this big fear of conflict. I did a lot of psychometric, if you will, type things, which is kind of the word that we use in the L&D world, but it really is like personality assessments, Enneagram, insights, which is the, you know, the red, blue, green, yellow, if you're familiar with that one, just about learning my own style. And I found that I'm a very accommodating person and leader. And so that can have, that's a double-edged sword. I find that I can be very conflict avoidant, like I mentioned. So I can be long-winded, like I probably am right now. And I didn't have a strong enough point of view on certain issues that my team really needed to feel some confidence, even when I didn't know the answer, that I could have a here's how I'm going to get the answer type level of confidence. So those were a few things that I learned, sometimes the hard way.
Lots of things to dig into there. I'm going to start with the fear of conflict. So is this something that you first really recognize once you did the psychometric tests, or is this something that you knew and then it was just kind of validated when you also saw it in the personality tests?
I feel like I kind of knew it, but I was maybe denying. I was a little bit in denial that I was the type of person who feared conflict. I mean, I grew up playing. I was the co-captain of my football team. I'm 6 feet, 190 pounds. Like, I'm not like a small person. I feel like I could kind of hold my own, if you will. But in reality, it was before when I saw this thing about that I scored higher on avoiding conflict. And I really had to think about, actually, I do. And there are little ways that I can get stubborn or that I can be passive aggressive in how I handle interpersonal interactions sometimes. And at first it felt like, yeah, that kind of didn't feel great. But the more I learned about it, the more I realized I've got natural strengths that relate to my fear of conflict. Things around being a great mediator. I can mediate conflict. Being a great listener. Being just a friendly, kind person. Wanting there to be harmony amongst a team. A good harmony, like harmony as in we're all working well together toward mutual outcomes. So yeah, it was definitely something I had to embrace and learn how to navigate.
This is really interesting because, especially in this case, you're saying that maybe you could have said that I knew this in advance, but it was really the test that made you think about it. And then as you thought about it, you maybe kind of leaned into what it actually meant. So for people out there that maybe have an inkling that this is an area of strength and weakness at the same time. Every characteristic has a little bit of both. What are some of the symptoms? Like, how did you know that this could be something that is true? Like, are there situations that would happen that you think that really validated for you that conflict might be something that you avoided?
When it came time to have a difficult conversation with maybe an underperforming team member, maybe even friends and family members outside of work, I would always get very uncomfortable. I would feel a lot of kind of flush in my head and my face. I would find myself squirming out of those situations through humor or through things would, after a while, be left unaddressed and they would fester. And in the case of an underperforming team member, it's got to be addressed at the end of the day. I think I attended a workshop once where the advice given to me was to be really successful in life and especially to be successful interpersonally and to really be growing as a human being, basically, you've got to embrace discomfort. And they framed it in a way where it's like, you actually are not growing. You don't know that you're actually successful until you're feeling discomfort. So discomfort is actually a good thing. Discomfort is something that tells you that you're actually growing and ultimately that can lead to success in business and life. And so that was a good reframe for me. Once those feelings of discomfort started coming up, instead of shooing them away, I was sort of like, okay, I guess I'm onto something here. And I guess I have to just learn how to be in this messy, uncomfortable moment and just get better at it, basically. Just get better at it and find the right words to use and maintain a level of respect and kindness at the same time and compassion. And it just takes a ton of practice. I mean, I just had to have a lot of difficult conversations.
It was almost like you noticed when you had those feelings and almost reframed them and use them as opportunities to actually grow in those situations. And maybe, dare I say, look forward to them when they do happen in a strange way.
I have found that that formula of embracing discomfort has led to growth and success for me.
So is this something that you use the help of an external coach to be able to resolve, or is this something that you were largely able to work on through self-reflection?
I definitely have used coaches and used a coach on this particular issue. I leveraged my previous leaders, managers who were good at this. I found people who are really good at conflict too. And I would just ask them, how do you, I remember talking to a friend who actually kind of loved conflict and watched how he would handle it and what he would do. And so it was a combination for sure, but I definitely embraced feedback and coaching.
Yeah. And so you've also worked with a ton of leaders. We're going to get into learning and development programs and how you train others at large companies. So for the person that actually likes conflict or leans into it, what is it? What frame of reference or like way of thinking do they have? What makes them like it?
I remember talking to a friend of mine who liked it, and he said he was leading a sales team. And for him, it was like, I just need to know what's happening, right? In order for me to hit my number every quarter, I need to have the absolute truth on the table as to like how the deals are going, how the team's doing, what struggles, you know, I don't want any surprises. So he would then just really kind of probe into situations and maybe even areas that might be uncomfortable because he wanted to see where things stood. He also had this thing about, I need to know where I stand, whether it's a relationship with my spouse, a relationship at work, whatever, I just need to know where I stand. And if I don't know that, I'm going to go and find out. And I'm going to do it very assertively. And it's funny, it's like this idea that, does anybody ever like, just take an argument with your partner or whatever, or a best friend, like, does anybody ever love doing that or look forward to having a really uncomfortable argument? And the answer is usually no. But then if you ask after an argument, like a healthy argument, not one where it was very unhealthy, but after a good healthy argument, did you feel better? And usually the answer is yes. So it's just remembering that, yeah, got to go through a little bit of heat to get to a good sort of mutual outcome and a strong relationship.
And definitely a really, really good story there. It seems that sometimes in service of almost like a higher order purpose, maybe it's truth seeking, maybe it's something else, maybe to get to a better outcome, clarity, that sometimes you have to use other tools. And so when you think of it that way, then it's almost like something that just needs to happen. It's almost a part of the process. I wanted to maybe dive into some of the, because you currently run a bunch of different interesting programs at Dropbox. And one of the things that you have is something called HIPPO development or high potential programs. Sounds super interesting. And I love the acronym. What is this program? And what kind of things do you all do with this program?
We call it HIPPO, or also we tend to call it, it stands for high potential, but honestly, that name has gotten a little bit contested, I would say, in recent years. What is high potential? What does that even mean? Just because one person's high potential, is another person not? So we've actually started calling them accelerator programs. The idea of an accelerator program is we want to build a bench of future leaders, right? So as a public company, Dropbox has has to look sort of name successors, ideally, right? And at least for the C-suite, even below that, though, we want to have a pipeline of leaders, a succession strategy that is feeding in new internal leaders so that we can be promoting leaders into more senior positions instead of hiring out all the time. So we have two main accelerator focus areas. One is the senior manager population, which would be cultivating for later director positions. And then we have a director, senior director population that we're cultivating for future VP roles. Each of those programs has a fairly heavy investment because, you know, we have important goals around building a strong bench of leaders. So, and I can give some examples if you like, of like how we develop leaders in those programs.
Yeah. How do you do it?
On the senior manager front, we call that program Ascent. We bring a group of about 20 to 25 leaders together into a cohort for about 6 months. And we start with a two-day intensive, bring them all together. And to start, they receive executive coaching. They then go into this two-day intensive program where we talk about T-shaped leadership. You know, what does that mean to lead across and down into your team? We talk a lot about stepping up, being able to zoom in and zoom out, so step up on the balcony. At the senior manager level, I find that people are just learning more and more to be strategic, right? And you're not just leading a team. You might be leading a couple of teams or teams of teams, and you've got to be able to get up on the balcony and see the bigger picture and see how your strategy connects to the bigger company strategies, and then be able to communicate and lead down into your teams. At the director level, that's even more important, but that's starting to happen at the senior manager level. So learning how to get on the balcony is an important skill. We also use peer coaching quite a bit. So we find that when a manager can bring a thorny situation into a trusted circle of peers and get some coaching around that, it can be a huge unlock for it. Sometimes they bring issues that they're not maybe super comfortable bringing to their manager, or they don't have a coach yet, and we want to, you know, just get them an ability to share with each other. And we find those super, super valuable. One of the things I've been very blown away by is the level of vulnerability that people in these cohorts will bring. And when they can just show up as their human selves, messy, mistake-making humans, they just get a lot of value from the relationship building they get and the mutual support that they get. And we find sometimes in the program closing, people shed tears. It's like there's lots of growth happening through those experiences. A lot of it driven by vulnerability.
Hey everyone, just a quick pause on today's episode to tell you about a new feature that I am so excited about. We've been working on this one for quite a while and excited to announce it to the world. We're calling it Meeting Guidelines. So there's all these things that people already know they should do when they organize a meeting. So for example, you should make sure that you shouldn't invite too many people. Or if you're booking a recurring meeting, you probably want to put an end date on that meeting. Or if you're going to invite someone to a meeting, you should probably, you know, if they have more than 20 hours of meetings that week, maybe be a little bit more considerate and ask, should I really invite that person to the meeting? So there's a bunch of these sorts of things that, you know, you might even know about, but what happens somehow in larger organizations is that people forget all of these things. And so that's why we've built this feature called Meeting Guidelines. It's super easy to use. It's a Google Chrome extension. So if you install it, what will happen is it will integrate with your Google Calendar. And that way, whenever anyone within your company is about to book a meeting, these meeting guidelines will show up and make sure that people know and take a second look at that meeting that they're about to book and make sure that it adheres to these guidelines. So if you want to book or within your company have a no meeting day, or if you want to make sure that every meeting has an agenda in advance before it's booked. So all the different sorts of guidelines that you may want, and they're all obviously highly configurable because every company is going to be slightly different, but this is the first time that there is a way that you can get an entire organization to change their meeting behavior. It's something that we've been working on for a very long time, super proud to announce it to the world. It's called Meeting Guidelines. If you're interested in checking it out, would love for you to do that and give us feedback. You can get to it by going to fellow.app/guidelines. Again, that's fellow.app/guidelines. Check it out and let me know what you think. Dropbox, obviously, large company, thousands of people. And so, you know, having a program like this makes a lot of sense. But a lot of other companies, even smaller companies, can do parts of this too, right? So they can maybe sponsor some executive coaching for members on their team, or the peer group seems like a much more achievable way to bring people together. How do these peer groups run? Do you run them? Are there facilitators? Does someone volunteer? What are the mechanics of that look like? So if, you know, someone's thinking about, you know, their organization, it's a few hundred person company, or it's even a 100-person company, and they're thinking, oh, it'd be really nice if we could use the managers or the leaders of the company in a peer group type format. How would you recommend that they structure something like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think that a lot can be done with less resources. I think the way we run those coaching circles is there's a set agenda, right? So you actually have a group of people. They are facilitated because we just do that for this program, but you can run them unfacilitated, but we give them a structure. It's basically the person who's being coached, we call it, they're in the leadership hot seat, and they've got an issue that they're going to bring to the group. They will speak about their issue for 2 minutes, and we time that. Then the rest of the group This is a group of like 4 to 6 people. The rest of the group will then ask questions, clarifying questions for about four to five minutes and gain more clarity about the situation. What have you tried? What are some things that are still, even though you've tried them, where are you stuck the most, etc. And then this is a kind of the fun part, then the person in the hot seat will actually turn their camera off because this is all done via Zoom. And the rest of the group gets to just share about them and talk about their issue and what they would do for the next 5 minutes or so.
Oh, so, but is that person still the hot seat person? Are they still on the call?
They're on the call, their screen's off to sort of symbolize that they're on the call, but they're, when we do it in person, the person actually turns their back and turns around and gets to hear, but it's really now the conversation's amongst the rest of the peers. And you can either give advice, like, here's what I would do if I were Aiden. Or you can say, here's what I've done before in this situation. Or you can say, you know, here's what I'm still wondering about. And all of that's really valuable information for the person in the hot seat. And they always walk away with at least a couple nuggets that were hugely, hugely valuable, including just being heard, right? Including just being sort of validated that, yeah, this is a really thorny problem that other people have faced. So that's something you can do. Mentorship is something you can do. You can involve other leaders like directors and VPs in the company to host some fireside chats. We do that as part of this program and just share their perspectives on certain issues or bring in elements of the company strategy. So we call that exposure. Sometimes people just need to hear a little bit more about how the leadership team are thinking about the company strategy and executing the strategy than just what you might hear in an all-hands meeting. Right? So a little bit more high touch, a little bit more exposure. And so those are a few things you can do without any money.
I really love the format and it's super interesting. And to get a little bit more tactical here too, in terms of the selection of the people, when you think about the 4 to 6 people that are in this group, maybe there's some obvious ones you wouldn't have. Do you try and have people from like different parts of the company such that they don't typically interact? Or is there any sort of tips and tricks?
We do a few different, there's a few couple lenses we put on it. So the first major lens is the talent review and the 9-box format, which is kind of a classic approach to talent reviews. We categorize leaders essentially into different boxes. Are they high, you know, top talent? There's a few top boxes in the 9-box that essentially identify potential future leaders. So we start there, and that's a pretty wide net. From there, we look at cross-functional groups. We want to have, you know, engineering, product design, sales, you know, G&A functions represented. After that, we also look at geography. You know, so we look at, we're heavy in sort of EMEA, in Asia Pac, and in North America, we're the heaviest. So we try to do a bit of a balance as much as we can. And then we also apply a diversity lens to it. So at Dropbox, women and underrepresented minorities, which are Black and Latino employees, are part of our sort of focus groups. So we bring a lens of that into the selection process. So that's how we put it all together.
Oh, so this is in terms of how you select the people into the program.
Yeah, the actual cohort of 25 people or so. And then the 4 to 6 people, yeah, we try to also build some level of cross-functional aspects and diversity aspects as much as possible.
Yeah, got it. And so in a smaller company setting, some sensitive information will be talked about because maybe you're talking about effectively a lot of times management issues are people issues. And so people on the team that other people may know. And I assume there's some sort of like confidentiality procedure.
What happens in the circle stays in the circle, your typical Vegas rule. So yes, that's actually paramount. And one of the things that we emphasize heavily is confidentiality. We also ask them to anonymize, so not use actual names, but you can say like a team member of mine, a partner, you know, a stakeholder of mine, etc. So we can protect the innocent and the guilty, as it were.
This is super, super helpful. And I'm sure it's something that everybody can try and implement in their own companies. And these peer group formats are super useful. I'm a part of a bunch of peer groups myself, and I always find them very, very valuable. And it's just sometimes even the clarifying questions that people ask get you to think about something in a different light. And it's always super refreshing to have other smart people think about your problems. I mean, I think it's a privilege to be able to do that.
It is important just to have a little bit of light structure, because I think what I found is if you just put together a handful of peers in a room and say, you know, go ahead and talk about managing, maybe a couple times you do that and people can self-organize and lead that. But it kind of falls apart after a while because people go, I don't really know what to talk about. But if you do that thing of like, what's your struggle right now? Or what's a blocker that you have? Or what's an issue? And then the 2 5-minute of questions, that basic structure really leads to strong outcomes.
Yeah. So just building these leadership programs or management programs in general, if you were to say, for example, how different is, you know, management at Dropbox or when you were at Quantcast or another company, how much of these programs are like very specialized towards managing at Dropbox, for example? Or is like general management practices 80% the same everywhere, 20% different? And for companies looking to build their own management programs, recognizing that management is an important skill in their company, trying to up-level managers everywhere, like how should they think about it? Should they hire an external firm? Should they get everybody to read a book? How should they go about this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I do think it probably is like 70% the same across most companies and 30%, this is not an exact science, but 30% where you want to make it bespoke to the company you're at, the culture you're at. For example, you just mentioned book. Dropbox is a book-heavy culture. Our CEO reads a lot. He recommends books. He expects people to actually read the book if it's around a certain topic that's important to the company at the moment. So we're a book culture. Maybe not all companies are, right? So maybe not all companies would do books. So there is that aspect of like knowing your culture, knowing your leadership and what works. But at the same time, the 70% of what's the same is being a frontline manager has many similarities across probably any company you would go to, right? You've just gone from IC to a manager. You're trying to figure out how to delegate. You're trying to figure out how to give feedback and coach your team. You're trying to figure out, what do I do for team building? And a lot of those things are going to be similar challenges a lot of employees would face. So what we do is at each of those key transitions, so a transition from IC to manager, transition from leading team to leading teams of teams, so like senior manager, kind of director level, then at the probably like senior director or certainly VP and above, now you're leading full functions, you're leading in a org. And at the C-suite, the same kind of idea, like each of those has specific transitions that we want to target, very specific behaviors and leadership qualities and capabilities. So we would have programming at each of those sort of layers. That's core, I would say, you know, core programming to support those transitions. And then from there, we do electives. We offer various different ways for leaders to plug in, depending on how things are done at Dropbox. One example is at Dropbox, we have the benefit of a lot of people show up for workshops. Like if we design a 2-hour or even 3-hour workshop, let's say about mastering influence, that is usually pretty well attended. If you can imagine 3 hours on Zoom, you know, it's not a short amount of time. And historically, we've had pretty decent attendance for all of our Zoom. It used to be live in person before COVID, but now a lot of it's over Zoom and it's working quite well. So we get good attendance at Dropbox. I would say I'm very lucky as an L&D leader in that regard. I think a lot of companies struggle with that. Now, that said, we've gotten feedback lately that our business is shifting to be, we need to focus on a very specific key areas as a company for the next couple of years. And our teams have gotten laser focused on the business. And that's meant that they do have less time for a 3-hour workshop. So we're shifting things. We're really moving toward in the flow of work as much as possible, which means minimizing the amount of workshop time, additional async learning, micro learning, nudge type approaches to learning, better content management. And so there's some shifts that we're making like that.
This is all super interesting. And so just to really drive the point home, so in the 30% of things that might be different, I think this is very important for people to kind of contextualize. What's an example of something that maybe is different or something that's emphasized at Dropbox, but for the management and leadership there, but is maybe not as important at another company?
I would say, I mentioned the book one, and even recently, Drew, our CEO, and the leadership team read the book Zone to Win by Jeffrey Moore, and it's very applicable to a lot of organizations. It's a great book, and we built a whole manager summit on some of the content from that book, and now it's been applied at Dropbox, and that was an example of something very bespoke for our company. One of the things we're trying to do more and more of, because we're a virtual first company now, is more self-serve resources. And this is something we're doing more of, trying to gain adoption. So, for example, historically, our team development, we do team effectiveness, where we help teams run team building sessions or run offsites. A lot of that was high touch. Now we're good, trying to move toward providing toolkits and playbooks for managers to then just take. So any given manager could run their own offsite and have a whole set of learning sort of team building exercises they could run with their team without a facilitator present. So self-serve has become a very important aspect of Dropbox. Design is a very important thing. Dropbox product, if you're familiar with it, is always been a highly designed user experience. I mean, that's one of the things customers love about Dropbox. It just works and it's intuitive. And so there's a lot of emphasis internally on really slick slide decks, right? Clean, simple, easy to understand. And so we try to apply that lens into everything we design as well. So those are a couple of different examples. And then we're a people-centric culture at Dropbox. And so there's a level of friendliness. There's a level of relationship importance. And people want interaction with each other. They don't want to just show up. And honestly, one of the criticisms we've received as an L&D team is we can be a little wonky sometimes, a little framework heavy, a little theoretical. And people, at the end of the day, really want connection and they want peer learning and they want an emphasis on relationships first and foremost.
As we were getting ready to press record, we were talking about AI and how that relates to learning within companies. And so I know that you've been thinking about this a lot recently. What can you tell us about things that you've learned or ways that you're thinking about AI and how it incorporates into what you do?
Yeah, so AI has become a central sort of initiative, AI learning. We have an AI center of excellence that was developed earlier in the year. Dropbox made a very intentional announcement earlier this year to become an AI-first company, meaning in everything we do, in every product that we build, we are adopting AI as a central sort of strategy and so forth. And we've already started releasing AI-based products and so forth. So we, as a learning team, have developed a strategy around essentially building AI proficiency across the entire company. Now, one of the first things we did was we had to find who are the main audiences. And we ended up with kind of five key audiences. We have product engineers. We have ML engineers, so actual machine learning engineers who do that as their day job. We have product managers who are driving the next generation of AI features. We have G&A folks, so all other non-technical, you know, finance, HR, legal, et cetera, sales. And then we have our executives, so leaders. How should leaders be thinking about strategically leading teams around the future of AI? So within each of those five audiences, then we have goals, right? We have each of them have specific topics. So obviously the technical folks, the software engineers, it gets very technical very quickly. And with the non-technical folks, it's been about more foundational learning about AI, about generative AI. And then another aspect of it is the practice. We need to really learn AI, you have to build, you have to practice. And so whether that's an engineer coding, you're learning how to develop models and so on and algorithms, or it's a G&A, it's a legal or a finance or an HR person learning how to use ChatGPT to accelerate their workflows. We're really putting together practice labs and getting people actually hands on keyboard, trying this stuff out. And we have our own internal tools that we've got people trying out and adopting. And so that's a big piece of it. And then we've also consulted or brought in external learning providers, companies like Udacity and DataCamp that we're piloting right now to figure out how to train engineers and upskill.
Yeah. And what I find really interesting about this, Justin, is that, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with peer CEOs, people who run organizations, and there is broad desire for a lot of people to bring more AI into their companies and get people to think about AI first, like the way that you're talking about. And what's really interesting about the approach that you all are taking is that it almost becomes a broad initiative. And it sounds like you've thought about it a lot. You've thought about it across the different departments. And it's not just a thing that just happens because in a town hall or something, the CEO says, hey, everybody, focus on AI. It's a broad initiative. It requires reinforcement. It requires the tools. And it's really interesting how the L&D team is like a very strong part of making sure that that happens. So it's very interesting to see all of that. We've talked about a lot of different things today and lots of different concepts. One of the things that we always like to end on is to kind of get some parting words of wisdom. So for all the managers and leaders constantly looking to get better at their craft, are there any final tips, tricks, or advice that you would leave them with?
I think leading a team is more than just being good at feedback and coaching. I think that it's also thinking about the entire team and the team dynamics. And so one book that I always recommend is Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. It's kind of a classic. I mean, it's been around for, a decade or two, but it's written in fable format. So it's actually a relatively engaging book as far as management and leadership books go. And it's just got a lot of really good lessons for a manager who's trying to think about getting the team really in a place of high performance and cohesion. And then I think one of the things that I did that's made me a better manager, because not only do I run an L&D function, but I've led teams for over 10 years, is I'm trained as a executive coach. And I remember seeing 80% of the participants of these coaching programs would be other coaches, right? Obviously, right? They're just learning. They're becoming certified because they're an executive coach as their trade. At least 20%, maybe sometimes more, would be just managers, right? That are never planning to be sort of a coach as a job, but really wanted to be a better leader. And so we're learning the craft of coaching. I would always submit to really deepen your craft as a manager is less about the functional expertise that you have, and whether it's sales or marketing or engineering or whatever, but it's about learning some of the soft skills really, really, really well, right? Learning what is strategic thinking and planning really mean? What is coaching and establishing a vision, operational excellence? So really seek out those types of learning opportunities. The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker is a classic book too. It's kind of dry and really antiquated in some of the language, but the wisdom in it is timeless. So that's a classic. And then business books like Zone to Win or Dual Transformation, or the folks at Amazon have written a lot of amazing stuff about how to lead through different processes that has made Amazon successful, actually have been quite interesting to read about. And there's a lot out there you can find. So those are a few things I'd suggest.
Lots of great things in there and lots of great advice. Justin, thank you so much for doing this.
You bet. Thanks, Aiden. Appreciate the opportunity and thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. You can find the show notes and transcript at www.fellow.app/supermanagers. If you like the content, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so you can get notified when we post the next episode. And please tell your friends and fellow managers about it. It'd be awesome if you could help us spread the word about the show. See you next time.